I was healthy. Drew made him a mini pancake this morning with the dogs.
That's so cute.
He made pancakes, and then he goes, I'm going to make one for everybody. And so Al's pancake was, like, this big. And then Al still didn't want to eat it, so Drew had to rip it up in pieces, and he goes, don't tell anybody that. And I go, oh, I'm telling people.
He cut up the pancake for the cat.
That he made pancakes for all of our animals and then cut it up into bite-sized pieces because Al's picky.
It's so cute.
I was like, hey, he's not going to eat that. And he goes, he doesn't want it when it's this big. I was like, yeah. But cats are picky with, like, bread for some reason. I mean, not all of them. But some of them are like, I only want it in small pieces because I don't want to try and chew.
I just want to slurp it up.
Then there's Opera who just eats toys whole.
Just, oh gosh, like a python.
She hasn't done it in a while. Opera, why are you that way? She's like, they're delicious.
Is it due to lack of opportunity or just...
I don't know, because we do let her have the toys out, and we're barely ever not at home.
So I wonder if part of it was, like...
Just being starving to death?
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a very strange... Well, it's not that strange, but I picked a paranormal, and then it was, like, extremely, extremely short. But I was sitting there, and this was after I had gotten a semi-promotion at work, and so I was, like, stressed out and had extra work to do and still, mm-hmm. like, still do now. So now I'm, like, busier, but I had sat down to, like, do this research, and then it was so short and there was barely anything, and I was like, well, I'm not deleting it and just doing something else. So I just found an additional small story to add on to it, so that's what we're doing today. So the first part of my story is covering... The King's Chapel Burying Ground. I got my information from Wikipedia.org, Boston.gov, GhostsAndGravestones.com, and then GhostCityTours.com. So there's only a very short history. The King's Chapel Burying Ground was founded in 1630 as the first graveyard in the city of Boston. It was Boston's only burial ground for like 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it had quite a few bodies in it. In 1686, an Anglican congregation was allotted land in the graveyard to build King's Chapel after they couldn't find land anywhere else. And I'm like, that was just weird to me. I was like, okay, so go outside of the city limits. Like, what, why do you have to build in, like, on a graveyard? Because you want to be the church in town. Chill out. So there... Today,
I need to be right.
Well, I just
thought
that was weird because it said in every article that they couldn't find land anywhere else, so they like basically forced their way to having the church on the graveyard
anywhere else.
And I was like, there's barely any land taken in 1686. You could have definitely found land elsewhere. I thought that was so weird.
And here's the thing. I was thinking about it from modern perspectives, where it's like tough. Go elsewhere or use a building that already exists.
It's 1686. Who else has the land?
And I understand that means if you're not in certain spaces, it's going to be a lot harder for anyone to get to you. But like, hey, I don't know what to tell you. Tough.
But also, like I said, like building right outside of Boston, like you would have found somewhere right outside of Boston. That's why I'm like, I'm confused. Sorry, everybody. I don't know how to make that sound go off. Anyway. So today there are 505 headstones and 59 footstones remaining from the over 1,000 people buried here. I assume there's still 1,000 people buried here, at least. But I don't know. There are also 78 tombs, but 36... of them only have markers remaining. One of which is a vault built as a charnel house. How do you say that?
Charnel? I assume like...
Which was converted into a tomb for children's remains in 1833 when all them kids be dying of all the fevers and whatnot. So most of the tombs are in tabletop form. The earliest graves and tombs are scattered randomly throughout the grounds with no formal pathways.
Do you want to know what a charnel house is? It's where you, like, put loose bones.
On a shelf. Look at that one's organized. Yeah, this one's just thrown about. That one's organized. Like the Paris tunnels, basically.
The Paris tunnels, but, like...
More chaotic.
It can be chaotic or not, but, like, it's the idea of you're storing all of the bones in the most, like, practical way, like, stacking them in a way where they take up the least amount of space.
Making room, yeah.
is what they seem to be.
In the early 19th century, landscaped cemeteries started to become those pretty walking parks that I've talked mm-hmm. about in the, like, the, what was it, the Pet Cemetery Stephen King episode? Mm-hmm. So pedestrian footpaths and ornamental cast iron fences and various plants were added to make the graveyard nicer for visitors. But during this, they rearranged the gravestones into straight rows, so I'm pretty sure, like, not a single gravestone, like, matches up to anybody's anymore. No. So, like, really, I don't think they have a clue who's buried where anymore. So, some of the notable people who are buried here, or were, because I'm sure there's, like, a point where they were moving graves and, like, whatnot, and probably just didn't tell anybody.
Oh, yeah. For sure not everybody is buried there that was originally
Massachusetts' first governor, John Winthrop, William Dawes, I've heard that name, but I don't know who he is, Paul Revere's compatriot, who, on his ride to Lexington in 1775, Reverend John Cotton, Captain Kidd,
there's a bunch of fun people. Ezekiel Usher,
the first Ezekiel Usher, who was the first printer and publisher, like, in America, and Mary Chilton, who some people think was the first woman to step off of the Mayflower. So, okay.
So the story that I'm going to do next week is also a cemetery, and I'm like, you know, I did the classic, like, list off famous people who were buried there,
yeah.
And I gotta say right now, that list right there, way cooler than the list that I have.
I don't even know the list of these people.
No, I know, but, like, I understand how these people play, like, important roles in history.
Yeah.
Like, why are they notable? Most, like, there was, like, no, like, you'll hear nobody interesting.
That's okay. There's some cemeteries where they're like, these are our famous people, and I'm like, no one cares. No, not a single person who knows who that is.
And, like, I don't mean, like, there's some important people buried there.
Yeah.
But I mean, like fun dead people, not, you know, the fifth president of the United States.
Yeah.
Like, that, okay, cool.
I don't even know the majority of, like, the originals.
Monroe or Mason or McMahon, I don't know what it is. I think it's the fifth.
You know, sometimes I wonder how, like, their family line is doing, or if they're all gone at this point. You know, the early presidents, or just influential people in America, you know what I mean?
The one president who has, like, grandkids alive still from the early ones.
I don't know, but that's a weird story. I'll wait to get onto the hauntings until I get
to this. Spoilers for next week. John Tyler has living grandkids right now. John Tyler is the 10th president of the United States. Number 10. His grandson is still alive, and it's from his child, Lion Tyler, and both of them are buried in that cemetery I'm going to talk about.
How interesting.
Which is so funny. But yeah, he had, like, kids way late in life, like the president did. Like, super late in life.
That's crazy.
So, like, he was, like, in his 80s when he had... Is it the 70s son. Or 80s when he had, like, the son that had... Who's, like, the father of the kid that's alive now.
63.
Yeah, he was 63 when Lion was born. And then Lion had a kid when he was 75. But, like, that child that was born when he was 75 is... still alive now, because there's not been a lot of time between the founding of the U.S. and now, when you, like, really think about generation-wise, like, it's not a lot of people.
So weird.
So that's a preview to...
Next week.
He's one of the only interesting people buried there, so now you already know. What a shame.
Well, I'll forget by next week anyway. So, on to the hauntings. So, visitors have claimed to hear disembodied voices, experience sudden chills, and feel like they're being touched, grabbed, or pushed while visiting the grounds. They're like, get off of my body. These people have no respect. They moved my stone. Like, get off of me.
Yep.
People visiting at night have claimed to hear muffled screams coming from the ground, and they always describe it as hearing multiple voices screaming.
That's a fun haunted thing.
That's great.
I absolutely, the first thing I think of when I think of in the middle of a city, underground you're hearing screams is the steam tunnels. I don't know if those are a universal thing, but they're a very big St. Louis thing. There's very large steam tunnels in St. Louis that a lot of people live in for obvious reasons. And I assume all old cities have these. They may not, but I assume bad things are happening in the steam tunnels.
I don't know. It's not necessarily, like, close enough to the cemetery to hear it.
The steam tunnels?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on where they go.
To the cemetery.
They might be.
Well, I'm saying it might not be. I don't know.
I don't know. No one... Here's the thing. Our steam tunnels aren't mapped. I assume Boston's aren't mapped either, then.
I don't know. I don't know anything about steam tunnels. One of the more notable ghosts is that of Captain Kidd, who buried here after his execution for piracy.
I love that he was still buried in a cemetery. It's actually sort of surprising.
I think he was, like, beheaded.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
But he, like, I feel like he should be, like, thrown into the ocean or put in a pauper's space.
I don't know.
Space, you know?
Guests say that they have heard him, like, his voice, which, like, I don't know how you can... How do you know his voice? But they also say that they've seen him. I don't know. They just say they've heard his voice. So I'm like, how do you know what he sounds like?
Also, how do they know it's Captain Kidd? Because I'm going to tell you right now, if he's looking like how he is most of the time in his, like, primary portraits, you're not going to know the difference between him and, like, Ben Franklin, basically.
Yeah,
not that he looks like Ben Franklin, but, like,
they all look the same.
They all wearing those white curly wigs.
Yeah.
Like, and here's the thing, he could be looking like the fictionalized version of the pirate that, like, people know him as.
But it looks so much cooler that way.
There's no paintings of him as, like, a pirate from the time.
Our flag means death, but not
Spanish?
That color hair. No, because our flag means death, like the guy. He looks like him.
Oh, like,
Well, they're like, this guy's not a pirate.
What's his name?
The main character.
Yeah, the main character. But that's exactly, like, that's how he looks like in a singular portrait.
That's what he would look like on a pirate ship in my mind.
Existed. So I'm wondering if people are seeing that or they're just seeing, like, a run-of-the-mill pirate. Like, what are they seeing? That they think it's Captain Kidd.
Anyway, so some guests say they'll catch orbs, see slight flashes of light, and see shadowy figures, as well as videos disappearing from people's cameras, like, when they go to check, their phone or their digital camera. There's a legend that a woman was set to be buried here, but they made her coffin too short, and so the carpenter decapitated her and then placed her head between her legs so she would fit in the coffin.
She's not the only person that has happened to, by the way.
And so some visitors have claimed to see a headless woman wandering around the graveyard ever since.
They'll chop off the head, they'll also chop off the feet.
Yeah.
Depending on...
She is most often spotted in the west... Sorry, I just choked. In the westernmost portion of the cemetery. There's also a tale, like, because back then they were saying how, like, everybody's just buried willy-nilly. Like, wherever someone wasn't just freshly buried, or if they were freshly buried, good,
then
their ground's not hard.
They weren't putting rows, they were just shoving wherever they could. Yeah.
There is also a tale of a man who was buried alive. Not, like, alive, like, they were doing it to kill him, but, you know, how they had to put those bells and stuff in people's coffins because they were just, like, deathly, but not actually dead.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Like, they're, like, one breath a minute.
Yeah. and he is said to still haunt the grounds. It was said that he was buried alive by his family. Well, he was, this is kind of bad. So it was said that he was buried alive by his family members who wanted ownership of his property. And an old woman who led a group of people to the cemetery demanded the grave to be opened, and they found the body to be dead, but they also found fingernail marks on the inside of the coffin.
Ew.
So, but like I said, I still think he was, like, sick, but, like,
I think he was dying.
Was like, yeah, time for you to go, buddy.
And it was taking too long for him to die.
So anyway, that's all I have on the King's Chapel burying ground.
But it's so fun.
I know, it's kind of good. It's just so short. And in the research they made, it seemed like it was the most interesting haunted cemetery in the world. And I was like, this is kind of lackluster. So on to our next story, which is about Marie Agnor. So I got my information from newspapers.com, the Boston Globe article from September 23rd, 1920, and then the St. Albans Daily Messenger article. I think it's... from the newspaper, too, from September 24th, 1920. So this is also very short, but it was just a weird story that I saw when I was trying to find more information on the cemetery. So, it was one of the weird things that you see out of the corner of your eye, and you're like, what is that? So, New York, September 22nd, quote, this is straight from, both of the things I'm about to read are straight from the newspaper articles I just said. Mm-hmm. An alleged confession of murder was found written on a wall in the bathroom on the second floor of a cottage in the course of construction at 1011 East 19th Street, Brooklyn, this afternoon. The writer states he is being haunted by the face of the victim, a woman, and would be dead when the writing was discovered.
Fun.
Charles Guthrie of 83 Traction Street, Brooklyn, went to the building to lay a tiled floor in the bathroom. He read this writing on the side of the room, quote, I must write my confession before I kill myself, so that whoever reads this should notify the police, because by this time, I will be dead. I killed Marie Agnor of Manchester, Vermont, June 15th, 1920. I cannot live longer because wherever I go, I am haunted. So, kind reader, have pity on me. I am the name, not James Drosher, who killed her. So I'm assuming there was, I don't know. But anyway, notify the police so that he may go free. I, and then the name is, redacted, of Brooklyn, killed her with a gun that will be found at the toll gate at the road leading to Rutland. End quote. So, the name of the writer is withheld because it was impossible tonight to ascertain whether he is guilty or the perpetrator of a hoax. The confession was accompanied by a digital purport, or a, why did I say digital? This is 1920. The confession was accompanied by a diagram purporting to show where the pistol was hidden. Detectives communicated with the Manchester, Vermont, authorities, who sent back word that they had no record of such a case, but they would investigate further. And then now is the September 24th newspaper article. Quote, Sheriff J.D. Purdy of Manchester stated over the telephone last evening to a representative of the Herald that an investigation by him had failed to locate Marie Agnor or James Drosher as ever having been residents of Manchester. He also stated that an inquiry was made at the Equinox Hotel and other hosteries as to whether persons with the above names were ever employed. These names, he reported, could not be found among the lists of employees at any of the hotels. The sheriff believes that the quote-unquote confession is a fake or the work of some crank. The toll bridge is located near Peru and is about 2 miles from Manchester Depot. And I tried so hard to find any more information on this and found absolutely nothing. So I'm like, maybe there really was somebody that got murdered and they either, never found the body or nobody ever reported her missing or...
But, so weird. Or it could be a weird hoax. On it.
But it's also, if you're doing a weird hoax, you would just leave a note. I don't think you'd be writing a diagram as to where you hid your gun after killing somebody.
Yeah.
But I don't know. But anyway, those are my two stories for today.
That's very fun.
And I also was like, man, if you would have given the name of the guy who wrote the note, I could have looked into those newspaper articles and stuff, but unfortunately I didn't find any.
That's so weird.
I know. I literally spent so long searching for Marie Agnor, but it ends, all of it ends in 1920. Anything that's relevant to the weird, hoax. And all the newspapers just say it's, a hoax. And I'm just like, this is so weird. And I'm also like, just because I don't live in Manchester doesn't mean they weren't happening to be in Manchester when it happened. And also, why would you just assume that if they didn't live there, they must be working at a hotel? That's the only explanation.
Yeah, it is interesting.
But anyway, I just thought it was so weird. I was like, there's no way it's on someone else's podcast because
no.
There's nothing about it. And it's just interesting.
Weird little newspaper story. Well, I liked the weird little newspaper story.
I know. I did too. I was like, this leaves me with more questions than answers. I literally don't. This is so weird.
I have to
weird.
Purposely not do newspaper stories sometimes because they're always so weird and little and yes. I never get more information. Yeah. I have to do some other ones where there's now history on it too. Someone's reflected.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to do all the original research.
But I think they literally didn't look into it after. They were like, nobody lives here that was named that, so we're done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are we ready?
I believe so.
Next one. Oh my. Oh my. I forgot how long this was.
Good thing mine are short.
So this is the story of the Hoosac Tunnel. My sources are the Obscure Vermont, Wikipedia, John Henry vs. Charles Burley's Drill, by Doreen
Chackey.
That most of it's Obscure Vermont Wikipedia. That is just like a weird thing where I had to technically go to it and read from it. And I was like, well, I guess I got to put it on here now. It's for like a one-lined point, but
that's
I did have to click on it and read it. So the Hoosac Tunnel is located in the Berkshire Hills in western Massachusetts. It is a 4.75-mile long railroad tunnel, and it cuts specifically through the Hoosac Mountain Range. I don't know how the Berkshire Hills and the Hoosac Mountain Range differ, that they are both the location.
Mm-hmm.
But now you know. So local legend has twisted the meaning of Hoosac to mean forbidden in some native language. Like that's like the story, and you know, the native word for forbidden. It's not. It's an Algonquin rooted word that translates to like stony place, or like place of stones, place of rocks.
Which is
a mountain.
A description of where it actually is.
Yeah, it's a description of the mountain. So it's obviously less ominous and is an accurate description.
It was me.
Okay. So the tunnel was completed in 1873 for the Pan Am Southern Freight Main Line, though they are not the ones who started this whole process. So cutting through the mountain range was originally proposed in 1819 to form a channel system, which is, I didn't know it was going to be a tunnel or if they're going to cut all the way straight through. I assume it's going to be a channel tunnel, so a water-based tunnel, that was supposed to help connect Boston to upstate New York. And when I
for
think
what
about,
like boats,
yes,
okay,
like for because there's a complex channel systems in like the eastern U.S. before they had railroads, because water was the fastest way to get anywhere. So they were just going to add on to that. There's a channel system that sort of goes nearby, so they're just sort of, I think, going to tie into that. And when I think what was originally researching, I'm like, that's insane. Why would you put a tunnel of water through a mountain? But we'll get down further to see why, honestly, that might have been a better bet. it would have been problematic for similar reasons, but like it wasn't as bad, crazy of an idea as I thought when I was first reading that. So in the 1840s, so it's put to rest, though. They don't actually do it. In the 1840s, the idea is brought back out. The new, I think it's supposed to be Troy and not Tory. I think it's Troy and Greenfield Railroad, but it might be Troy and Greenfield Railroad. Anyway, they pick up the idea of cutting through the mountain in the same spot as was previously discussed, and they start this in 1851, but their efforts to like efficiently do it are blocked consistently until 1861. They're blocked by, primarily by this guy named Wester W. Chapin, who...
Interesting name.
Chester W. Chapin, who may or may not have definitely owned a competing rail line that took the southern route that was longer. So that may or may not have been why he was blocking this tunnel from being built. Either way, in 1861, he was no longer able to consistently lobby for it not to be built because he decided to become a general in the Union Army.
Interesting.
Which meant, as the lobbying was gone, they were actually able to start work on it, like, fully. They were working on it, because the exit's in a different state.
Yeah.
So either, I don't know if they were working from the Vermont side or the Massachusetts side first, but I assume that's what they were doing, is they were working on the opposite state side. So Chapin's plan did work, though, because the Troy and Greenfield Railroad did foreclose in 1862 because they couldn't get their stinking railroad up and running for, you know, like 20 years due to this guy. So the state of Massachusetts took over the tunnel project. The state of Massachusetts is like, honestly, it is a good idea. We could use a tunnel right there for railroad purposes. So in 1868, $5 million are offered for the building of the tunnel, and drilling and cutting is finished in 1873. It took 2 years after that to refine the tunnel, you know, adding enlargements where necessary, necessary reinforcing weak areas, adding drains, finishing the facades of the entrances. And then the first train passes through in 1875. So during construction, around 2 million tons of rock were removed, which is a lot of rock.
That's a lot.
Early on in the process, they tried to use the Wilson's patented stone cutting machine, but it failed. Didn't even excavate 10 feet into the mountain.
Oh.
Which is honestly very sad for more than one reason.
Big bummer.
Because, like, they got this big, expensive machine out there to do this. It didn't work. That sucks. Two, the rock, really soft. They thought it was hard rock when they first did, like, their initial geological things, but whoever did that was bad at their job. It's very soft rock. So it's even more pathetic that this thing couldn't cut through.
I'm imagining a guy, like, going up and, like, knocking on it and being like, yeah, that's pretty tough. My test is concluded.
So from 1853...
What if it was the owner of the machine that conducted the test?
That could have been. And yeah, it's like, hard yeah, rock. You guys. Use my machine.
And it's really great, so... Take my word for it.
Honestly, that 100% tracks for the time period. I'm not saying that's true at all.
I know
I'm saying that is entirely a thing that could happen.
But I mean, back then, it's like the people that had the things were also the ones going out and doing the things. Uh-huh. So that's
lucky them. Absolutely.
Now you have all the ammo and nobody wants you to do anything. Mm-hmm. So they're like, nope, we're not listening to you.
So from 1853 until 1868, the tunnel was excavated by hand. Inching along at an average of 2 feet per day.
How many people were, like, working on this? I feel like...
I never got a good number on how many
people were consistently working. I feel like if you had a lot of big, strong men, you could get more than 2 feet a day.
Well, it's a big tunnel. So it's not like, 2 feet in. It's the entire, you know, 2 feet of, like...
Oh, further.
Further of, like, the entire shape, basically. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. So it's, you know, 20 feet tall and 20 feet wide.
I'm thinking each of them are doing, like, a little 2 foot hole, and they're like, all right.
No, it would be like...
done for the day.
20 by 20 by 2.
Okay. That's better.
I don't know the exact dimensions, but that's the kind of space that they're opening up. So, yeah, and then after 1868, when, like, the state's fully invested in this, they employ the Burley drilling machine, which is this, using the... That's when I had to go to that one little weird source that was, like, comparing two old-timey, like, drilling methods.
That's so weird.
The Burley drilling machine, though, is, like a big name drilling machine at the time.
It's,
like, a big innovation change. So it was really impressive that they got to use it on this project. But anyway, the construction of the tunnel was also the first time that nitroglycerin and electric blasting caps were used in a commercial large scale in the U.S. So that's part of, like, the digging by hand, was they were, like, having to drill, shove in the little blowy up bits.
And run.
Like that, skadoodle, clear out the stuff, then drill.
Yeah, I'd be too tired for that.
So that's what, they're not, like, pickaxing the whole entire thing.
Yeah.
They're doing small blasts, but that's still a lot slower than drilling. Well, especially since you're hand drilling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Burley drill might literally, I'm thinking a giant bore. Why would it be that? It's a little drill, I'm pretty sure. It's drilling those holes for you.
It could be a big one.
It could be either. It could be all of the above. Maybe it has multiple attachments. I don't know. I didn't look into
that.
It. I didn't think about it until right now. It's not like a KitchenAid mixer. Okay, attach the pasta maker. Okay, so the central shaft was dug for two reasons. One, ventilation is important. Two, it gave them four spots to dig from, so they would, like, they dug out the central shaft and then sent people down, and then you could dig east and west from the middle as well as east and west from the outside until it, like, eventually meet, which is, like, should theoretically increase the speed of excavation, but it also creates a new issue of you have to, like, line up four tunnels now. I know that sounds funny because it's not, it doesn't seem like it's four tunnels, it seems like it's less, but
yeah,
four digging lines need to be lined up to hit each other. It was just, they did an amazing job with it using, like, a lot of piano wire. I don't know how they did it, but they used a lot of piano wire. And they were only off by an inch when they eventually all met.
Are they cut in clay or something? What?
No, it's something like they lined up on top. But here's the thing. I understand how you can line up lines on top of a mountain. I understand that, like, surveying idea, right? I don't understand how you communicate where the line is into, like, when you're down in the hole? Does that, like, when you're picking away, how do you
I don't know
where
how people did things. I don't know how people do them now. I don't know how they did them back then.
Yeah, honestly, I wouldn't know how you do it now either.
And if you try to explain to me that it's this computer doing something, just don't even waste your breath.
Just tell me which way to dig, man. Just tell me which way to dig.
Literally, I do not care the logistics of it.
Anyway, so the central shaft needed a 1,000-foot elevator to hoist the rock out of the center tunnel. And just, like, some fun little tidbits. The east portal met the center tunnel first on December 12th. Yeah, the portal is where you enter the mountain.
I don't know what you call it,
like, a portal. The entrance to a tunnel is a portal. Isn't that fun? So the east portal, which I think is the Massachusetts side, met the center tunnel first on December 12th, 1872. And then the west portal hit the center tunnel on November 27th, 1873. So almost a year later. So I don't know if they were that off center or if, like, the rock was, like, what was happening, that there was a year delay.
Maybe it's just longer.
But, well, it could also be, though, that the east portal is where they got to start sooner. If my theory of they were able to start on one state side but not the other state side. And they were just further in on that one than the other one. I also know the west portal had a whole bunch of water issues, though, so maybe that's it.
Yeah.
So the tunnel is considered an early tunneling feat due to the use of technology between the nitroglycerin and that, like, Burley drilling machine. Mm-hmm. Both of those were, like, big innovation things, so it's considered special for that, even though it's not, like, an amazing tunnel otherwise. Though at the time of its completion, it was the second longest tunnel in the world, after the Mont Cenis Tunnel in the French Alps, which is 8.5 miles, so just under double the length of this one. So it was a long tunnel then.
Yeah.
And when you go to the list of, like, longest tunnels now, they're all, like, modern, not, like, yeah, modern constructed, like, aqueduct systems. They're not even, like, tunnels that, like, people need to be able to go into.
Yeah.
Which I also think is, those are two different feats. Like, yeah, you drilled that far, and there's something that has to pass through it, but it's not, like, regularly people and explosives.
Mm-hmm.
I just always assume there's lots of explosives on trains, between the train itself and the weird things they always are carrying.
Fair enough.
So the litigation around the construction of the tunnel was not the only struggles the builders faced. 195 builders were seriously injured building the tunnel. And then 135 verified deaths occurred in its construction. I don't know if the 135 is like, taking from the seriously injured ones, or if they're two separate numbers.
Yeah.
That was not clear to me. So explosions, falling rocks, and ladder and scaffolding accidents were the main hazards, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Those are basically all the hazards when it comes to building a tunnel.
Don't fall.
And so now we're going to list off some of the bad times.
Okay.
So in 1865, workers went on strike due to the hazardous conditions, because
it's hazardous.
Building a tunnel is a bad time. And they burnt some buildings in protest. That's how big of a strike it was.
Chill out.
But I think it clearly got resolved, because they're still building. They still built it. Like, I don't know what got changed. Maybe it was just a whole bunch of scabs. Who knows? I didn't look into it. Anyway, on October 17th, 1867, the deadliest single accident occurred in the tunnel.
Oh.
Workers were digging a 1,028-foot vertical exhaust shaft when the candle on the hoist, so, like, the thing that's bringing the elevator up and down, ignited the naphtha fumes coming from a gasometer lamp. Which is some lamp that burns petroleum product. There's no such thing as a gasometer, but, like, I think that's what it's called in, like, official reports.
Yeah.
And it was just something that people called certain things then, but it's not a real name for anything. Either way, so it's some kind of oil lamp. This caused an explosion that set the hoist on fire and collapsed the shaft. Four men on the top of the shaft managed to escape, and then 13 men who were 538 feet below were trapped by the falling iron and the burning naphtha liquid.
Not good.
The naphtha, I feel like I'm saying it very wrong. It's N-A-P-H-T-H-A.
Naphtha.
Anyway. So the water and air pump in the shaft were destroyed during all of this falling and burning. So the shaft quickly filled with water and the breathable air quickly decreased.
Oh, jeez.
And then there's also this burning liquid coming down. So that's also not improving the air quality down there.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
The next day, a man...
That should work.
The next day, a man named Mallory was lowered into the shaft, but wasn't able to reach the bottom due to the fumes. The suffocating conditions were determined in a very lovely way. They sent three lanterns down with Mallory, and once two of the three were snuffed out, it was considered that the air was bad. Oh. Because if the first one goes out, it could be like it wasn't lit well enough. There's an issue with the gas. A little breeze caught it.
Yeah.
But if two go out, that's no longer like... Nope, that means there's not enough oxygen. That's not
a coincidence, yeah.
So he's pulled back up. By the time Mallory made it to the surface, he was only able to utter no hope before passing out. Oh, my. So it was... There were some fumes in there. So no further rescue efforts were made.
They didn't have, like, a little bird down there or something? Wait, that's for gas, isn't it?
Well, this would be gas.
Oh.
If there's... Because...
The lack of
oxygen doesn't mean there's not other gases there. It definitely means there's other gases there. The space is always filled with gas, unless you're in a vacuum.
I'm sorry.
Either way, no, there was no... The canary was the lamps.
The living and man.
The lamps and the man were the canary. So, yeah, no further rescue efforts were made. Then several months later, they finally go back to continue digging that shaft. They need the shaft. And they reach the bottom, and they find that a number of men had initially survived, like, the collapse and burning and stuff, long enough to build a raft, but were most likely suffocated by the fumes. Some people are like, maybe they starved to death. And it's like, it takes a long, like
weeks. It takes quite a long time to like, starve to death.
Not weeks, but, like, a week to starve to death. And if the guy passed out just from going not even all the way down, like, there's... Unless there's a weird, weird patch of temporary oxygen, I still don't think there... That still wouldn't be enough to make it so they could starve to death. I think they suffocated. I bet it was, like, pretty similar, like carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
They just went to sleep. So nitroglycerin was another common killer.
Woohoo!
As it was used... as it was new to the builders, this is the new thing that people are using in this kind of...
They're the experimenters.
Basically. So a lot of people were learning how to use it. So there's a number of premature explosions that either blew the person apart entirely, they're just gone, or crushed them with rubble because it caused like a cave-in when they were too close.
I think I'd rather be blown apart.
I think I'd rather be blown apart too. You can get like crushed and lived for a little bit. It'd be like missing limbs and like, ugh. Anyway. So on March 20th, 1865, Ringo Kelly prematurely set up a blast which crushed two of his fellow builders, Ned Brinkman and Billy Nash. Not long after this happened, Kelly disappeared. They assumed it was from the guilt of killing what I assume were his, like, closest coworkers, because they're probably always doing this together. So at the same time that Kelly disappeared, there started to be reports of seeing the angry ghosts of Nash and Berkman, like, around the area where they were crushed to death. And then exactly 1 year later, Kelly showed up again. He did show up dead. He had been strangled to death and was laying in the exact spot where Nash and Berkman had died the year before in the collapse. So it was like a crazy revenge killing. So the murder was
not even just a revenge killing, a revenge anniversary killing.
Yeah, a revenge, which is wild. Like, 100%, that's crazy. Whoever did that blamed him. Like, this is,
it was his fault, they're not wrong.
100% believed it was, honestly, I would assume, not on accident, like, purposeful, like, there was a vendetta or something.
I mean, maybe he did, and then he wanted everybody to think they were friends, but that's why he ran away, because he was like, my plan did work out, but they might arrest me if I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
You never
know. Like, Kelly might have done it on purpose, and then someone else was like, I know you did it on purpose, and then did this. Anyway, so he was strangled to death, laying in the exact spot where the other guys had died the year before. The murder was investigated by Deputy Sheriff Charles E. Gibson, and it was determined that Kelly had been killed between midnight and 3 a.m., like, the just before they had found him that day. So, like, he would not have been laying there long. And then no further clues were identified. No suspect was determined. I think they were like, it's not worth it. Because clearly, like, this was... The motivation is clear. And
the issue is
investigating
resolved.
It further is not going to, like, produce anything other than make us down at least one worker.
Yeah. That's true.
So another issue, safety-wise, was the stone itself. Like I said before, it was soft stone. It was weak and porous, so it was prone to collapsing. I didn't look into it.
Sorry, I'm yawning. I'm super tired.
Do you want me to look into it? Now I'm curious, so I'm going to.
I mean, it'll come up really quick, I would assume.
It should probably tell me, right? Because it didn't mention it in anything I was, like, reading specifically, because most people don't care what rocks are.
I would have said, Hoosag Mountain's made of what stone?
No, you wouldn't do geology.
Nope. Stone Hoosac Mountain.
Stone Hoosac Mountain. You know, we'll try that, because geology didn't work.
One of the things was made of glass. That would present an issue.
Be very brittle. Oh, we don't. That's going to take so long to load.
Yeah.
Looks like mostly schist. I don't know how hard schist is, though.
Phyllite, quartzite, and grantiac. Grantic. Granitic.
Are you sure phyllite?
That's what it says.
What's phyllite? I know rhyolite.
It's the eastern rank of the valley, apparently.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the issue rock, though.
The phyllite?
Yeah.
I would assume that's how you say it anyway. Anyway, that's what it's made of, the eastern portion. For anybody wondering what kind of rock it is.
I know, a metamorphic like and sedimentary me. Combo. And I think they probably, like, literally, like, found one of the good, one of those twos, and were like, look, it's all this nice rock.
Oh.
Like, if it's, a quartzite, that should be a better rock. And they just found the quartzite and didn't look at the other. They're like, oh, and here's some shale. Oops.
Yeah.
Because shale is not dirty, if you're curious.
I mean, it sounds like frail, so.
Yeah. So, yeah, the rock is weak and porous, prone to collapsing. Builders compared it to building a sandcastle in the mud. Mason stone was used to line the walls to increase stability of the tunnel. Like, you only have to stabilize, I guess, so much of the portals of the tunnel for the most of the rest of the tunnel to be okay. Just needing, like, occasional, like, arches.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely lined with this mason stone. But they went, like, significantly further in from the portals than normal because it was so mushy.
That reminded me of the Taskmaster episode where that one person just kept repeating, there's strength in arches. There's strength in arches. Because right. They had to build, like, a tunnel it wasn't a tunnel. They had to build a...
I need to watch more of that.
A little bridge for something to, like... it was, like, a cow figurine to stand on or a horse. I think it was a horse figurine. It was like, there's strength in arches. He was, like, trying to... That's what it reminded me of. Anyway.
Particularly, the western portal was so wet and unstable that a secondary tunnel had to be made to drain the water out.
Jeez.
The site wasn't just, like, damp all the time. It wasn't, like, cave, but it was, like, inundated, like, flooded.
It's a swamp.
it was an underground swamp. So, I don't know why people were shocked that it was so freaking wet here. Because not only are both portals at, like, rivers, so, like, the east portal is at the confluence of the Cascade Brook and the Deerfield River, which means it's not crossing either of those, but it's coming out right at them, right? So there's a lot of water right there. The west portal, on the other hand, exits underneath a river.
No.
I mean, technically, it's the Tunnel Brook, is what it's called. But it is a waterway, and it exits under it.
I'm like, I don't get it. Why is there water leaking in here?
It's so wet, I don't understand. There's also an entire river that, like, goes on top of the space where the tunnel is. It's the Cold River. That's what it's called. It has a number of tributaries that also go into it on top of the space where the tunnel is. Like, I don't know why it's wet. So it would have probably been better as a channel. As a channel tunnel.
Yeah.
Oh, that is...
It is a channel. That's what they're called.
Well, okay. The channel is because it goes under a channel. But it would also be a tunnel if it was a channel and a tunnel.
Yeah.
Tunnel of both ways. Because the tunnel is dry and has, like, railroads.
Like a big one from England to France. Well, in my mind, it can also be wet and you can float across it.
Yeah. I think it can be both. I think both can be called a channel. Anyway, paranormal. Because that's why we're here. In case you forgot. So Nash and Berkman are not the only ghosts that are talked about during the tunnel construction. People were always talking about seeing shadowy figures in the dark tunnels. It was like a pretty common thing for workers to talk about. And the tunnels just being haunted in general was a common rumor.
They could have been hallucinating on the gases.
It could be that. I have a theory that we'll get to later.
Okay.
So before the re-entry of the shaft site, where, like, those 13 people died, people claimed to see fleeting shapes that would, like, slowly fade away, and then they would hear, like, muffled disembodied groans and cries from the earth itself. But as soon as, like, they did the re-entry and, like, discovered the bodies and, like, the how they died, it was never reported again.
Hmm.
In 1872, before the tunnel was completed, Dr. Clifford J. Owens went on an expedition into the tunnel at night to investigate the paranormal phenomena that builders had been experiencing over the years, which is so cool.
That's funny. He's like, I gotta see for myself. And James, I'm going at night, because that's the scariest time.
Yep. James McKinstry, the drilling and superintendent, joined him. Like, he accompanied him into the mine. So these two guys went down. And now I have a quote from the book Pinprick of Light by Carl R. Bryan, which is apparently a quote from them.
Okay.
That is in this book. I don't know where he got this quote because I didn't read the book. This is a source from a source. Anyway. So we have traveled about 2 miles into the shaft when we halted to rest. Except for the dim, smoky light cast by our lamps, the place was so cold and dark as a tomb. Suddenly I heard a strange, mournful sound. The next thing I saw was a dim light coming from a westerly direction. At first, I believed it was a workman with a lantern. Yet, as it drew closer, it took on a strange blue color and the form of a human being without a head. The light seemed to be floating along about a foot or two above the tunnel floor. The headless form came so close I could have reached out and touched it, but I was too terrified to move. The apparition stood, and that's the end of it, terrified. So the apparition was said to have stood motionless in front of them for a time before floating back west, which is towards, like, the end of, like, there's no exit over there.
Yeah.
That's still inside the mountain. so he's floating that back whence he came.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a fun old-timey account.
It is.
So on October of 1874, Frank Webster, who was hunting above the tunnel, or the area around the tunnel at least, went missing. There was a little search party went out for him. He was found a few days later in shock. He said he had heard voices that enticed him to enter the tunnel.
And sirens in there.
Yeah. Well, it was like a siren something or other is what was used to describe this. Inside the tunnel, he said a ghostly figure took his rifle and beat him with it. he had the injuries that would be indicative of being beaten with a rifle, and he also no longer had a rifle. I firmly think he was mugged.
Yeah, there's no way it wasn't.
By a human.
Regular humans. If that is a ghost, that is the best ghost story I've ever heard in my life, and that is hilarious.
And then in 1875, Harlan Mulvaney, an employee of the Boston and Maine Railroad, was set to deliver a cartload of wood near the tunnel. Instead, he fled the area in panic and was never heard from again, so something around there terrified him. It also could be that there was an attempted mugging.
Yeah.
I think there just might be
like
some,
like... that man wasn't in shock. He has a severe concussion.
Yeah. I think there's just some highway robbery activity happening at this tunnel.
Seems like it.
Especially, and I think between the highway robbery that was obviously happening towards the end there when there's clearly fewer builders, especially on that one side, because they're basically done with it. I also think most of the ghost stories that were from while it's happening are a combination of, like, people just telling, the workers telling stories to entertain themselves.
Yeah. 'Cause
their job sucks. and then the workers pretending to be ghosts and scaring the living daylights out of fellow workers and that one doctor investigating the one time.
Yeah.
I so 100% think that's what's happening. I don't think this tunnel is haunted. I think it's all people playing tricks and doing crimes.
Is the tunnel, like, still used today?
I don't think it's currently used today, but I do believe
it still exists. Because I was going to say, I want to know if there's any still stories from, like, today, you know?
I didn't see any. It's always these old ones.
Interesting.
Here, we'll go to the...
Is that person. A biker? Well, he had a helmet on, I thought.
I don't know if it still uses a railroad tunnel, but it does look like it's still fully intact. So if you want to hike...
It's creepy looking.
Do a 10-mile round
hike. It's considered a historic landmark, so I would assume you can go in it. There's no...
It doesn't look like it blocked off. It has a
good rating.
And it might be blocked off, like, partially in. Yeah, there's not access all the way through. The East Portal has more public access as of 2 years ago than the West does.
I like that he's upset that an old tunnel doesn't have as much access as he would like it to have.
Yeah, they're very angry because it's a huge piece of railroad history in this area and it should be set up to be used as such. I don't understand.
Okay, then you give them the money to do that and keep it maintained so nothing falls in your head and kills you. I was like, they probably
stopped it because something after that is no longer stable enough to... But you see, this is the portal... Mm-hmm. This is the brook, and the tunnel goes this way. So it enters, Dummies. It goes underneath the brook and comes out, and they're like, it's wet. And then if we go, hold on, further out. Let me fight with my... This is the other portal. The line goes here. You see, so this, it's exiting right at this other waterway.
Oh my gosh.
And then you can see all of this water that's on top of it. There might Dummies. As well be a lake.
Yeah.
It's so wet up there. Because it's not going through a mountain, it's going through like a series of ridges.
Hills.
Yeah. So like it's literally it goes through a valley and doesn't come out during that time. It enters at the base of a bluff, basically. Goes through underneath another valley and then comes out on another side of a different ridge.
That's
like going
funny.
Through two ridge lines, the whole valley in the middle, and I can't understand how that was the most reasonable thing to do in that space. Just come up here briefly, make a little bridge, then keep going.
Yeah.
I've seen that before.
Well, that was interesting. I've never heard of that.
I neither. I really didn't know where it was going. I just kept writing until I hoped that there's something at the end
when
I got to the rifle story and I was like, oh, I understand everything now.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
This is just pranks.
Yeah.
Pranks and crimes.
A lot of them probably are.
Oh, a lot of them are pranks and crimes. A lot of hauntings, I firmly believe, are pranks and crimes.
Well, anyway, so try not to kill anybody.
Oh. Audrey was done.
Don't mess with Ouija boards.
Bye. Bye.